Okay, so you're back for more deep dives, huh? You really can't get enough of these legal cases, can you? Well, we're back with another one. We're digging into a case today from the Indiana Supreme Court. Trinity Homes, LLC v. Frank Y. Fang. Buckle up.
This one goes back to 2006. It might seem like a pretty narrow issue at first, you know, just about like who pays property taxes after a piece of land gets divided up and sold off. But trust me, this thing goes way deeper than just taxes. We're going to uncover some big principles of contract law and property law too, stuff that's still super important today.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, at the end of the day, it all comes down to one little tax provision in a home purchase agreement. You wouldn't think something that sounds so simple could cause so much trouble and end up in the highest court of the state. But let me tell you, even the tiniest details in these contracts can have a huge impact. And the fact that the lower courts actually disagreed with the Supreme Court, that just shows you how tricky this stuff can be.
Yeah, that difference of opinion right there, that's a big clue.
Yeah.
You got the trial court and the court of appeals both siding with the buyer, Mr. Fang. Then the Supreme Court comes in and flips the script. That tells you there was something really messy and complicated about how to understand and apply this contract.
Totally. So let's set the stage here. Back in 1999, we have Frank Fang entering into an agreement to buy Lot 38. This was part of a new development called Brittany Chase, and the seller was Trinity Homes, the developer. So those are our two main players. Now, what was the exact language in this purchase agreement that kicked off this whole legal battle?
The heart of the matter is what they call the tax provision. Basically, Trinity Homes agreed to pay all real estate taxes and assessments, which are due and payable with respect to the real estate at the closing. Oh, and they also agreed to pay the first real estate installment due after settlement. I mean, on the surface, it seems pretty clear-cut, doesn't it?
Yeah, you think so.
Yeah.
But then you throw in the whole mess of property tax assessment schedules and things get complicated fast. So to see where things went off the rails, let's take a look at the timeline. So property taxes for 1999. This is important. We're talking about the entire undivided tract of land, the whole thing before it became Brittany Chase. Those taxes were assessed on March 1st, 1999. Standard assessment date.
All right. So then the closing on Mr. Fang's purchase of Lot 38, that happened on March 3rd, 2000, just over a year later. And like the agreement said, Trinity Homes paid the property tax installments that came due in May and November of 2000. Now, here's a key point. Those payments were still based on the 1999 assessment of the entire property. Remember, they hadn't divided it up into individual lots for tax purposes yet.
Right. I mean, it takes time to go through the whole legal process of subdividing land and getting those individual assessments, right? So in this case, those individual assessments didn't get sorted out until the spring of 2001. And that's when Mr. Fang got hit with property tax bill. This one was specifically for Lot 38, and it was for the May 2001 installment. And that's when the real fight began. Was this May 2001 installment the first real estate installment due after settlement that Trinity Homes was supposed to pay?
Bingo. That's the big question that landed right in the lap of the Indiana Supreme Court. They had to figure out what that phrase in the tax provision really meant, due and payable with respect to the real estate. Did it mean the taxes on the big undivided chunk of land? Or did it only mean taxes specifically assessed on Lot 38 after it was its own separate piece? It might seem like a small difference in wording, but this case proves it can lead to some pretty big consequences.
And, like we said, the lower courts actually sided with Mr. Fang on this. The trial court even went so far as to say that the tax provision was ambiguous, like it could be interpreted in more than one way, which I guess goes to show that even when contract language seems straightforward, it can still turn into a legal nightmare.
Absolutely. It shows you how tough it is to write a contract that covers every possible situation. But then the Indiana Supreme Court stepped in, right? Justice Bohm wrote the majority opinion, and they ended up seeing things differently.
Yeah. So let's break down the Supreme Court's logic here. What was their reasoning for overturning the lower court's decisions?
Their main argument was basically that the taxes assessed on that big undivided tract back in 1999 were actually due and payable with respect to Lot 38, even though technically at that point, Lot 38 wasn't a separate thing for tax purposes. The key here is that the obligation to pay property taxes isn't just about the assessment of a specific lot. It goes deeper than that. It can actually be tied to the land itself, going all the way back to the initial assessment. And they really emphasize this idea of a lien. Basically, a lien is like a legal claim against the property to make sure the taxes get paid. And in this case, the court said that 2000 property tax created a lien on the whole tract of land going back to March 1st, 1999. So that lien applied to every single lot that was created later on, including Lot 38.
Gotcha. So basically, even before Lot 38 officially existed as its own separate lot, it was still on the hook for those taxes from the original bigger piece of land.
Exactly. And the court went on to clarify that due and payable refers to when those payments actually have to be made. In Indiana, that's usually May and November, not when the taxes are assessed. So in the Supreme Court's view, when Trinity Homes paid those May and November 2000 installments, they were living up to their end of the deal to pay the taxes due and payable with respect to what would later become Lot 38.
Okay, that makes sense. So if you count those May and November 2000 payments as the first two installments after the closing that were related to Lot 38, then that May 2001 bill that Mr. Fang got stuck with was actually the third installment. And under the tax provision, that would make it his responsibility.
Exactly. And Justice Boehm actually laid it out really clearly in his opinion. He said, property taxes assessed on a single tract later subdivided are due and payable with respect to the lots, even if not individually assessed. That kind of sums up their whole point in one sentence.
So essentially, the Supreme Court looked at it as the tax obligation being tied to the land itself right from that first assessment, no matter how they chopped up the land later on. But we know there were always different perspectives in these cases. What was Justice Rucker's dissenting opinion?
Justice Rucker looked at that contract language from a completely different angle. He argued that the tax provision only applied to taxes on Lot 38 as a completely separate parcel, and he said there was no ambiguity about it. Since Lot 38 didn't become a separate lot for tax purposes until March 1st, 2000, Justice Rucker argued that the May 2001 installment was actually the very first one that came due after the closing for that specific lot. It's a classic example of how tricky it can be to balance the literal meaning of words in a contract with the bigger context and legal principles involved.
So for Justice Rucker, the key factor wasn't when they assessed the whole original piece of land. It was all about that first assessment that specifically targeted Lot 38 as its own taxable thing.
That's right. His dissent really zeroed in on the phrase with respect to the real estate and argued it specifically meant a lot #38 because that's exactly how they wrote it in the purchase agreement. He basically felt like the majority was stretching the meaning of the contract way beyond what anyone intended just to make it fit their interpretation. And he even had a quote that really hammered that home. The agreement's language clearly limits Trinity's obligation to taxes on the identified lot. I mean, that sums up their disagreement pretty well.
It's just wild to me how two experienced legal minds can look at the exact same contract and come to such completely opposite conclusions. This case really proves how incredibly important it is to use precise and crystal clear language in legal agreements. So for all our listeners out there, especially you law students, why is this case, Trinity Homes v. Fang, one you should really pay attention to?
Oh man, there are some major takeaways here for future lawyers. First and foremost, this case screams at you about the importance of clear drafting, especially when it comes to money stuff like property taxes and real estate deals. We saw how a little bit of ambiguity in a tax provision blew up into a huge legal mess that cost both sides a ton of time and money. It's like a flashing warning sign that you can't just glance over any part of a contract, even if it seems like standard boilerplate language.
For sure. It's a perfect example of how no detail is too small to overlook in a contract.
Definitely. And second, this case lays out a really important concept in property tax law. This idea that property taxes relate back to that initial assessment date, even if they divide the land up later. If you're planning to do any real estate law in Indiana, this is something you need to know. And chances are it's probably a similar principle in other states with similar property tax systems. The big takeaway is that responsibility for property taxes doesn't just magically appear when they create a new lot. It goes back to that first assessment of the original property.
So basically, the responsibility is baked into the land itself right from that first assessment.
Exactly. And last but not least, this case gives you a really good peek into how appeals work, specifically the standards that appellate courts use when they review small claims cases. So appellate courts will usually go with what the trial court decided about the facts of the case unless it's super obvious they got it wrong. But when it comes to legal questions like how to interpret a contract, they look at it with fresh eyes. It's what they call a de novo review. It's like the appellate court is saying, we're not just going to rubber stamp what the lower court said. We're going to figure this out ourselves. And that's exactly why the Supreme Court in this case felt totally comfortable overturning the decisions made by both the trial court and the Court of Appeals.
It all boils down to this. Trinity Homes v. Fang is a perfect example of how two completely reasonable interpretations of the same words in a contract can lead to completely different outcomes in court. And it really highlights how important it is to be super clear and precise in your contract drafting. That's how you avoid these expensive and time-consuming legal battles in the first place.
Absolutely. For anyone dealing with real estate transactions, the big lesson here is that you got to anticipate any potential ambiguity, especially when it comes to taxes on property that's going to be subdivided. The contract needs to spell out very clearly who's responsible for those taxes at every stage of the process, from development to assessment. No room for confusion.
So to wrap up our deep dive today, I want you to think about this. What if that tax provision in the purchase agreement had just stated clearly whether it applied to taxes on the whole undivided tract or just the new individual lot after the subdivision was finished? That one little clarification might have saved everyone years of headaches and legal fees. It really shows how important it is for you, future legal eagles, to be super careful and meticulous when you're drafting contracts. Make sure everyone's obligations are crystal clear right from the start, and there's no room for arguments. Thanks for joining us on this deep dive. We'll catch you next time.